What makes heaven, heaven? What's good about it? I suppose people have come up over the years with all kinds of answers. For the Prophet Muhammad, heaven is all to do with drinking sherbet and being waited on by beautiful dark-eyed maidens. It's a bit tough, of course, if you're a girl. For others, heaven's going to be one long party, a bit like Brighton Pier, only going on forever. Others, too, reckon that heaven's like a Saturday morning lie-in, with no kids around and no grass to mow. Dream on. And some people have looked at these ideas of heaven and basically felt that the whole thing's pretty trivial. The philosopher A.J. Eyre felt it was so banal and so boring, it just couldn't exist, and so really wasn't worth bothering with. Something that many of us have felt about A.J. Eyre himself. The pop singer Meat Loaf came out with a track, Heaven Can Wait. And he was getting at the idea that things in the here and now are what really matter, and where we should really put in the effort. Because, of course, heaven can wait. So what's our view? What makes heaven, heaven? Why is heaven worth bothering about? That's the $64,000 question. As Christians, we stake our all on heaven, don't we? We live in ways that the world thinks are mad for the sake of heaven. Even something as basic as turning out on a Sunday night to church is pretty odd to most of our fellow citizens. And come to that, we're going to be spending the next week in Contact 94 while wooing people to the idea that it's worth at least looking at being a Christian. That means that we'll be suggesting that heaven is indeed worth it. But is it? We need to be quite sure what we're recommending, both for our sakes and for theirs. If heaven isn't special, then it's not worth dying for, either in the sense of actually laying down your physical life or in the sense of dying to all the other things that God calls us to reject. And if we don't have a worthy heaven to die for, then as Christians, we don't have much to live for. And Contact 94 will only be an exercise in futility. So what makes heaven, heaven? We start to get an answer in this passage from Isaiah 4. So far, Isaiah's given us a pretty bleak picture, don't you think? There have been a number of devastating indictments on the life of Judah at every level, from her church through to her politicians, through to the housewife, to the man in the street. It's true that we've heard that God will spare a remnant, even when he acts in judgment. A remnant, a people who will be saved and forgiven, preserved from destruction. There is that thread of mercy running through all this. But overall, the picture is somber and sober. And maybe there's a bit of us that reacts quite bleakly and cynically to this. If the picture's so bad, why bother even trying to be part of this remnant on whom God has mercy? And if we catch that mood, it acts like poison on our will to follow Christ. We won't be bothered about our own lives and our relationship with him. We won't get too steamed up or enthusiastic about Contact 94. We'll end up playing at being Christians. A bit like the pub rugby team. You can always spot the pub rugby team on the odd Saturday afternoon that they do bother to turn out. Because, of course, they're the ones who are squeezed into the shorts that might have fitted 20 years ago but don't now. They're the ones who, well, they play for about 10 minutes, and then after that it's back to the pub for another quick one. Because, of course, there's a basic lack of seriousness. No training. Nothing else but a bit of fun on a Saturday afternoon. So let's look at the picture that God gives us here of the life of the remnant, the life of heaven. We're talking about what it's like to be one of the survivors of Israel, the phrase from verse 2, those who are actually there in heaven. This isn't, of course, a complete picture. It's just a start. But there are three areas that we're going to major on this evening. First, in verse 2, we're told about a person and the pride that people have in him. Second, in verses 3 and 4, we're told about a people and their purification. And then, in verses 5 and 6, we're told about a presence with that people. Nothing less than the presence of God. So let's look first at verse 2, the pride in a person. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. Now, at first glance, that is a bit obscure. But verse 2 really falls into two bits, doesn't it? The part about the branch and the part about the fruit. And those two things are parallel to each other. They're rather like a railway line. You know, you have two rails running parallel to each other, but reaching eventually the same destination. Not quite identical, they're in different positions on the ground, but running to the same point. And that's the idea behind verse 2. These two statements about the branch of the Lord and the fruit of the land run parallel to each other. They're making slightly different points, but they reach the same destination because they're talking about the same person. So let's look at that first part, the branch of the Lord. It's worth remembering that often when the Old Testament talks about a branch, it's talking about God's future promised king, the Messiah, the future king of God's people. That's exactly the way that the word branch is used later on in chapter 11, verse 1. If you just want to turn to that now to check that I'm not completely lying to you. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And it's talking, of course, about that descendant of Jesse, who's going to be God's chosen king for his people, as chapter 11 goes on to describe. And there are many other parts of the Old Testament which use branch in the same way, the future king of God's people. Whenever you come across a branch, though, it's worthwhile trying to sort out exactly what kind of a branch it is. On those rare days that I actually have enough time to sort of go gardening, I sort of wander along into the back of our particular garden, and I find that there are all kinds of branches hanging around. Now, I'm not much of a gardener myself, so what I have to do, of course, is sort of find the branch and then try and trace it back to wherever it's coming from. It's only then that I can find out whether we have a useful new sort of minor oak tree growing in the Ovie establishment, or whether in fact it's simply yet another outbreak of brambles. It's normally the latter. And this branch, of course, is nothing less than the branch of the Lord. That's the kind of branch that it is. And it's getting at the idea that God is the source of this branch. That the Messiah is sent by God and comes to do God's will. In that way, it's a reminder to us that the Jesus that we talk about, the Jesus we serve, isn't just a self-appointed king winning off following in this world, rather like a politician laying down a power base in an attempt to find people for his own purposes. No, Jesus is sent into our world by God. He is God the Father's agent in it. Now, when you remember the way that God has slated Judah in this book, that's immensely reassuring. Because it means that God has not washed his hands of us. He's not simply left us to it. He's still involved because there's his branch at work in the world. The second part of verse 2 rounds that off. The fruit of the land shall be the pride and the glory of the survivors of Israel. In a way, the Messiah was what everything was leading up to. All God's effort in bringing the Israelites to the promised land was to lead up to the Messiah. He was to be the fruit of the land. You often find yourself thinking about fruit in that kind of way. If you buy an apple tree, then what makes it a worthwhile apple tree is when it bears fruit. That's what it's for, when you're able to pluck the apples off the branches. It's no good if it just sort of sits there in the garden, not doing very much at all. And if you like, Isaiah's reminding us of the way that God's Messiah, Jesus, is the ultimate product of the people of God. He's the Israelite who remains true to God's law throughout his life, isn't he? Who loves God the Father unreservedly. He's everything an Israelite should be. In that way, he's the fruit of the land and of the people of God. And in this verse, Isaiah stresses something about this Messiah. He is the beauty, the glory, the pride of the survivors of Israel. That's to say, for God's people who aren't swept away by judgment, this Messiah is the person in whom they take pride, who counts as their glory. Now that sounds a bit obvious, but if we stop and think about it, it's a vital thing to say. Up to this point, the people of Israel, in chapters 1 to 3, have taken pride in a lot of things. They've gloried in this and that. They've sought various things as being beautiful. Power, wealth, money, comfort, prestige, adulation. They've been into all of it. But now, suddenly, we find that that focus has changed. The survivors focus on the Messiah. He is their pride. He's the center of their attention, of their effort. And of course, that's the feature of God's people, that the Messiah is central to them. And now that we know who the Messiah is and what he's done, we know how worthwhile it is to have him as central to our lives. Jesus the Messiah loves us freely, unconditionally, enough to die for us. His life is morally perfect, and his power great enough to conquer even death. But we personally do have to face the question whether we have Jesus the Messiah as our pride. Of course, there are very obvious alternatives to pride in Jesus. For the world, there's a pride and arrogance in our own worth. Sometimes because we do pride ourselves on being morally better than the bloke next door. Sometimes because we take our comfort from our achievements, maybe in the office, maybe just growing the best roses in Crowborough, maybe over the social position that we've got to. Those are very real snares for us. But there are subtler ones too. As a church family, where does our pride lie? Our range of activities? Our numbers? Our variety of services and music? Our house groups? And as we go into Contact 94, what will our friends and neighbours say about where our pride lies? Our regularity at Sunday worship, our track record as servants of the church, our skills as a church family altogether. None of those things are bad in themselves, but when we have them as our pride, then we're no longer God's people, because God's people have Christ as their pride. What is your pride in? What's mine? That takes us on to verses 3 and 4. He who has left in Zion remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst by a spirit of judgment and by a spirit of burning. We're talking about the purified people of God. And after what we've read, it's nothing minor that there is a people of God at all, because Judah has so signally failed God. But there is a people, and they're a holy people, verse 3. That's wonderful in itself, but let's just look at the qualifications of verse 4. Above all, they are a purified people, and they are purified by God. The Lord's done the washing. The Lord's cleansed the bloodstains. Our culture is rightly shaken by this kind of talk. It's very threatening, very frightening to think of God's anger and to see him act in judgment. We know what judgment meant for Isaiah's time. It meant conquest by a foreign army. It meant widespread destruction. It meant people being carried away to captivity. And we know too that that is a shadow, a model of God's final judgment. But in our hearts we know also that this judgment is necessary. If you look at verse 4, it's not the daughters of Israel who clean themselves. It's God who does it. And in all honesty, we know that unless God does do it, then it will not be done. Not completely, anyway. It's the old business, isn't it, of the New Year's resolution, when you determine that every Saturday afternoon you will do something in the garden. And slowly, week by week, you find the resolution ebbing away. You miss one week, then another, and then finally you stop altogether. Ultimately, we are unable to wash ourselves. That's why we need God to do it for us. And that's a reminder for us that in Contact 94, we're not simply putting an extra option before people. We're telling them about a necessity, for them as for us. But this cleansing, this judgment, is necessary from another point too. Without God's judgment, heaven could not last. Because for heaven to last, evil must be dealt with. The presence of evil, whether it's in us or whether it's in those around us, would contaminate heaven, wouldn't it? When I was much younger, I was a member of the Boys' Brigade, and every summer we used to be taken off and go camping under canvas on some major campsite somewhere in the south of England. And on one occasion we just got to the stage of putting the tent up and getting the bangers onto the fire, when another group showed up. It was one of those unpleasant little situations where immediately hackles were raised on both sides. The camping site was the best that we'd ever been on. It actually had running water, hot and cold, for a start. It had clean lavatories, I kid you not. It had everything going for it. And yet it's the camp that I remember with the most distaste. Simply because of who else was there. Who wants to live in heaven if the rapist still has a rapist's mentality? If the thief still, deep down, is a thief, the adulterer still an adulterer, it would poison heaven, wouldn't it? And we would have a God for whom those things wouldn't really matter. And that's a terrible thought. Evil must be dealt with. And the promise here is that it will be. And we know now how evil is dealt with. It's either dealt with as Jesus takes the guilt and the penalty that's the result of our evil from us and bears it himself. Or else, it's dealt with by us, as we bear the guilt and penalty for our evil ourselves. It remains with us, a tattoo on our souls, a stain that we can't get rid of, and that disqualifies us for heaven. And again, that's our privilege in Contact 94, to share with people that they need not bear their evil any longer themselves, and that they can enjoy an existence at the end of time in which they and others will be free from evil. Now that's a thought that deserves the name heaven. Forget the halo and the harp. This is worth it. The trouble is, as we hear that, we find ourselves wondering who will keep heaven as heaven. And that takes us to verses 5 and 6. Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy and a pavilion. And it will be for a shade by day from the heat and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. Those verses are talking to us of the presence of God. That's the point of Isaiah describing the cloud and the fire in verse 5. He's putting things in terms of what the Israelites have already experienced in the Exodus, when God showed his power by delivering them from Pharaoh and demonstrated his presence amongst his people by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. It was a reminder of God's permanent presence with his people day and night. For the people of Israel, it was a sign that God wasn't going to desert them halfway, that he wasn't going to get them free from slavery in Egypt, only to leave them in the lurch in the desert or in the battle for the promised land. And the same applies for us. The presence of God is our guarantee, our protection. That's exactly the way that verse 6 sees it. It will be a shade by day from the heat and a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. God's presence there is described poetically as a shield from the elements, meaning, of course, that we are completely safe because of God's presence. With him, nothing can threaten us. For we who are Christians, this is a real reminder of the worth of being God's people. It's easy to underplay that, don't you think? We do chafe sometimes at God's commands for our lives here and now, the standards of honesty or humility or consideration for others. They do seem to penalize us in a world of increasing dishonesty, where you look after number one, where you blow your own trumpet. It's easy too for us to overlook the massive security we have as Christians. We live in a world where all we work for can be swept away in a moment. An incompetent or biased manager can fire us. A business can go broke. A loved child can be estranged. A wife or a husband seduced. But nothing can rob us of heaven, because that alone is underwritten by God. For those two who aren't Christians, this is a passage of real hope. One of the most striking things about the way that many people see the world at the moment is their resignation. Political corruption? Bound to happen. Social disorder? Well, you can never really stop it. Living a good life? Bit pointless, really, because you can never keep it up. The pressures that tempt you and mould you, they're all too strong. And what's in common between all those things is that rather gloomy assumption that evil, one way or another, will always be there, whether in society or whether in us as individuals. It's inevitable. We can't ever quite stamp it out. But it's just there that this passage comes in, because this is an indication that at the end of the day, evil is not inevitable, because ultimately it can be dealt with by God and will be dealt with finally. It's nothing less than that that's on offer in Contact 94. Let's pray.